Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in History, a channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Zeb Larson, and I'm here today with Dr. Antonio Tomas to discuss his new biography of Amilcar Cabral. Dr. Tomas examines the life of Cabral, the roots of Cabral's ideology and nationalism, and the role that he played in the struggle against Portuguese imperialism in West Africa. Dr. Tomas, thank you for joining us today on the New Books Network. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Hi, my name is Antonio Tomas. I'm from Angola originally, and I spend a great part of my time, you know, abroad traveling. I lived in Portugal, where I went to college, and then I moved to the U.S. where I did my PhD in anthropology at Columbia University, and then I moved to Makerere. I worked at Makerere University for 1 year, and then I moved to first Cape Town, then Stellenbosch. And now I am based in Johannesburg, University of Johannesburg.
And for this particular book, which is about the life of Amilcar Cabral, what led you to this topic?
I was born in Angola, you know, before independence. Independence of Angola was in 1975. And for me, you know, and then Angola became a socialist country, and then during the Civil War, and so on. So growing up in Luanda, in Angola, during this time that, you know, the country was making a huge effort to, you know, to transform the economy and to become an African socialist country, I thought that there was a discrepancy between, on one hand, you know, all the celebrations of nationalism and the path that had led Angola into independence, you know, like the celebration of the revolution or the revolutionary moment on one hand, and on the other, the condition we lived in, you know, because the economy was severely damaged by the war, you know, and all the problems that, you know, are like the everyday life of an African city, you know, in terms of infrastructure, access to goods, and so on. So, and the people would talk a lot about Amilcar Cabral, you know. So I started reading about Amilcar Cabral. And then when I moved to Lisbon, you know, I sort of found a different version of Cabral, because in Portugal, Cabral was read and was talked about in a different way. So in Portugal, because Cabral was also a student in Lisbon, he moved to Portugal in 1949 to pursue his studies in agriculture. He became an agronomist. So he moved to Portugal as well. So, and then in Portugal, I found, you know, something that for me was I think my first encounter with racism, you know, a very particular post-colonial Portuguese racism. And actually, a lot of people of my generation, a lot of Africans were reading Cabral so as to come to terms with, you know, with all these questions that Cabral posed, asked in his time, you know, about colonialism, about relationship between Portugal and the colonies and so on. So I started to read Cabral and so on. So this book actually is a way to reconcile these two views of Cabral, you know, on one hand, how you use Cabral to understand revolution and particularly the relationship between revolution and what happened to, you know, African countries after independence. And on the other hand, you know, how to read Cabral in order to make an argument, in order to make a statement against racism and so on.
In terms of the literature that's been published or written so far about Cabral, how do you situate what you've written with what's come before?
I think this book is kind of, in a way, I would say original because of the fact that I think one of the few, I think I'm perhaps one of the few authors, at least in the Anglophone literature, that was born after the death of Cabral, you know. A great part of people who have written about Cabral were people who know Cabral or people who, you know, are from, you know, I would say the same time frame that Cabral occupied, you know. So you have a lot of people, you have some literature on Cabral in the 60s. Particularly after he died, you know, in the 70s and so on. People like an Angolan author as well, Mário Pinto de Andrade, who has written about Cabral. You have Oleg Ignatiev, Russian or Soviet, who has also written about Cabral. So one of the things about this literature is that this literature, I don't think that it doesn't challenge Cabral, you know, because actually it's a literature that uses the work of Cabral to make a certain argument against capitalism, against imperialism, and so on. So it doesn't engage us, for the most part, you know, this literature doesn't engage critically with Cabral. So I tried to do something different with this book, you know, is really to how to read Cabral in the context of how to provide a reading of Cabral from the historical perspective we are in now, you know. Because Cabral is a nationalist, so he fought for independence of Guinea-Cape Verde and by extension Angola and Mozambique and São Tomé as well, you know. So how to read Cabral beyond you know, the celebration of this important moment that was African independence, how to read Cabral critically through the mistakes that he made and so on. So this is a sort of the reading that I try to provide from, you know, and I think it's generational as well, from someone who was born after the killing, after the death of Cabral. I hope it makes sense.
No, I think that makes perfect sense. Before we dive too much more deeply into Cabral, I just wanted to ask you if you could provide for our listeners sort of a high-level view of who Cabral was, because they may not be familiar with his work or the broader sort of struggle against Portuguese colonialism in the 1960s and 1970s.
Okay. Cabral is a very interesting figure because in order to understand Cabral, we need to understand first Portugal Portuguese colonialism, the nature of Portuguese colonialism. And we need to understand particularly the relationship between Cape Verde and Guinea. You know, because they are different kinds of colonialism. And we know how the British colonized, you know, Nigeria and so on, and how the French colonized Algeria and Senegal, you know. And in each of these cases, the techniques used are different. In Portuguese colonialism is the same. So Portugal had two kinds of colonies. They had the, what they called the settlement colonies. They have the colonies like Angola and Mozambique, right? Where colonies they plan to send, contingent of white populations. Those are the settlement colonies. And they had other kinds of colonies, like Cape Verde. It was for a great part of the Portugal involvement in Africa, was not even considered a colony, because according to history, when the Portuguese arrived in Cape Verde, they didn't find any population. So they populated Cape Verde with people that they brought from Guinea, from the coast of West Africa. So what happened is that Portugal, for a great part of the time, you know, since 16th century onwards, didn't have like the same kind of social reality, social dynamics that other colonial powers had to face in Africa. You know, there was not a question of ethnicity. There was not a question of local languages. There was not a question of local culture in the way we talk about, you know, cultures in West Africa. The language spoken was Portuguese and Creole, which was a language that was developed through mixing, or through the combination between Portuguese and a number of African language from West Africa brought by slaves to Cape Verde. And actually, and also Cape Verde was the country that the Portuguese was one of the places in Africa, in Portuguese Africa, where the Portuguese start to invest in education and so on. So what happened is that in the 30s and 40s, the Portugal start to use Cape Verdeans to provide a sort of middle structure to provide people to help them in colonizing other places, you know, so as to provide the middle structure between colonizers and colonized. This happened in Angola, where a lot of Cape Verdeans moved to Angola, but this happened particularly in Guinea-Bissau, where Cabral was born of Cape Verdeans' parents, because it was very common for Cape Verdeans to move to Guinea and to work work in this middle strata, you know, as clerks, as professionals, and so on. So this creates a very interesting situation for Cape Verdeans in Guinea, you know, in which they were not colonized, but they were not colonizer either, although they were closer to the Portuguese, or they were providing the kind of work that the Portuguese needed to be done so that, you know, Guinea could be a colony, could be colonized. And this, of course, puts Cabral in a very particular position as well, being from Cape Verde and from Guinea, because he was born in Cape Verde. He was born in Guinea in 1924. He moved to Cape Verde in 1932. And he spent, you know, a few years in Cape Verde studying. And then he moved to Portugal, 49. And then he finished his studies in, he became an agronomist. And then he decided to move back to Guinea. And when he moved back to Guinea in the 50s, that was when he started to be engaged with nationalism. And I think like all the contradictions that I explain in the book arise from this double identity. So he then creates a party, the PAIGC, the PAIGC, which is a party that combine these two elements, right? Cape Verdeans and Guineans. So the idea was to create a party that would fight for a state that would proclaim independence of a state that would be these two countries together, you know, Cape Verde and Guinea. But the problem was that, you know, Cape Verdeans were not very, for the most part, Cape Verdeans were not very convinced that, you know, independence was a name to be achieved. Because for the most part, Cape Verdeans didn't feel colonized or didn't feel as colonized as many people in Angola or in Guinea would feel. So what happened is that the party that would have elements from Cape Verde and Guinea end up being, for the most part, a party where the great majority of people were from Guinea. And it's created, you know, a bunch of problems because during a certain moment in the struggle, Guineans start to ask questions about this. You know, why is that we are fighting for the independence of Cape Verde and Guinea, but we have like less than, you know, 50 Cape Verdeans here. And like for, you know, more than 2,000 or perhaps 5,000 Guineans. So this start to raise a lot of questions, you know. And I think that the killing of Cabral in 73 is also, I think also comes because of the fact that a number of these issues were not addressed in a proper manner.
So that was a really good high-level view of sort of the trajectory of Cabral's life. I want to rewind now a little bit and zero in on his early life. You note for our listeners the circumstances of his birth, but tell us a little bit about his family, about his relationship with the Cape Verde Islands as a child. How does that shape him?
So he moved to Cape Verde in 32 because his father Juvenal Cabral had received some money, some inheritance. So he moved with the family, and he had a second wife who became the mother of his brother you know, siblings, because Juvenal had more, you know, nobody knows, but I think more than 27 children. But Luis Cabral, he became a member of the PAIGC, and later on, the first president of Guinea-Bissau. So he moved to Cape Verde with his father and his stepmother and so on. And then in Cape Verde, he went to school. He went late to school, you know, because of the situation of divorce and so on. And then Cape Verde is very interesting in this time, because he goes to Liceu Gil Yang, the secondary school, and there is actually a lot of stuff going on, a lot of people writing poetry and so on, and a lot of people reading Brazilian poets, reading Brazilian literature, and start to ask questions about Cabo Verdeanidade, what is to be Cape Verdean. So we're talking about the 30s, right, where, questions of identity were a major preoccupation. So if you read, what Cabral has written in that time, there is not much difference between what he has written and what, any other Cape Verdean his age and his education or his background would read. So I think that he blended very well into this Cape Verdean mindset. But I think also there is another thing that needs to be highlighted in the terms of in how Cabral grew up in Cape Verde. Cape Verde is most of the islands, are very dry. So Cape Verdeans have dealt with a lot of natural issues like drought and famine and so on. So it was very frequent, that years without rain would cause great problems, and a lot of people would just starve to death. So I think that this experience of death, or this proximity to death, I think is something also that shaped Cabral, and shaped the struggles that he would be engaged with later in his life.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So, as you know, he then moves to Portugal, I think you said in 49, to study to become agronomist. And this is really one of my favorite chapters of the book, because it also highlights that this is chronologically sort of a hinge moment in Portuguese imperialism, too, that there's this shift going on in the metropole at the same time that Cabral is there. Can you sort of help us explore how Portuguese imperialism is shifting in this period, and then how his encounter in Portugal shapes Cabral?
This is a very good question. I was talking about the 30s, and the questions of identity and so on. I think that was because of fascism, fascism, particularly in Italy and Germany with Nazism, brought all these questions of identity to the fore. And Portugal with Salazar as well, Salazar was, even though a lot of people dispute that, but he was a fascist, So in the 30s, Salazar becomes the first minister of the colonies and then the president of the council and so on. So becomes the prime minister. So what Salazar does in, you know, first of all, was to deny that Portugal was a colonial power, right? So he integrates the colonies into Portugal, right? And we know how that in the 50s, Portugal even denied that it had colonies, you know, because they called them overseas provinces, you know, but this is in the 50s. So in the 40s, when Cabral arrives in Lisbon, that was the situation, right? Of Portugal trying to redesign colonialism, if I can say so. So one of the things that Salazar would say is that Portugal is not a small country. Portugal actually is a big country, and you can see the maps of Portugal, you know, in which all the colonies are combined, and Portugal has an area that occupy, you know, a great part of Europe with France and Spain, and so on. Another thing that he tries to do is to sort of to integrate the economy of the colonies into the economy of Portugal itself, right? In the sense that the colonies could only produce primary goods, you know, like Angola, cotton, coffee, and so on. And then these goods would be sent to Portugal, and Portugal would transform them, like cotton, you know, in textiles and so on. And then Portugal would re-export. So it was an economy that was completely subsidiary to the Portuguese economy. But there was a lot of poverty in Portugal as well, you know. And Cabral, he for his final for his dissertation, he goes to Cuba, a district of Portugal in Alentejo, you know. And I really think that the way he describes this particular agrarian society, which for him is not very different from what is going on or from the situation of peasants, not in Guinea but in Cape Verde, you know. I think this is when he comes to the conclusion that, and I think this is very important in Cabral's work, this separation between fascism, the separation between, just to understand what the war was about, you know. So he said many times that we are not fighting Portugal, we are not fighting Portuguese people, we are fighting fascism, you know. I think because I was because of this experience, you know. So, but one of the things that the Portuguese did, and I think Cabral has written about that, Mari Pinto de Andrade has written about that, and I think that was like how Portugal tried to give a positive image of colonialism was to use the work that was being developed by a Brazilian sociologist called Gilberto Freire. So Gilberto Freire came up with a theory called lusotropicalism. Lusotropicalism is, you know, it's an argument that he was making, that Brazil was a country devoid of racism or racial tension because of the nature of the Portuguese and the nature of Portuguese colonialism, you know, that the Portuguese were more plastic, they were more adaptable, and they didn't have problems with procreating with Indians and Africans and so on. So, people in Portugal, people like Salazar, found all these ideas very, very interesting. And then they tried to apply these to explain the presence of Portugal in Africa. So for people like Cabral in Lisbon, I think that was like a shock, you know, for them, because on one hand, the official discourse was about lusotropicalism, right? That the Portuguese had that Portuguese colonialism was not as brutal as British or French colonialism, that the Portuguese had a particular inclination to mix and to deal with uncivilized people. That was the expression then, the Africans particularly. But the reality of racism in Lisbon was brutal, you know, was a very strong thing. And I think this is, you know, also something that Cabral has thought that he had to fight against. So I really think that in this period of time, it's something that pushes Cabral into nationalism, you know, because he writes about that. He in the 60s, he writes a piece called Facts Against Colonialism. And one of the things that he does, one of the arguments that he makes in his speech, is exactly to dismantle this seemingly contradiction, you know, or an attempt of unmasking the regime, saying that, you know, all this stuff about lusotropicalism is a lie, because in reality, this is what is going on. You know? And he was very knowledgeable about the colonial economy and what Portugal was extracting from the colonies.
Now, as you note, it's when he returns finally from Portugal and goes to Guinea that he sort of commits fully to nationalism. It's this idea that's been sort of taking root for a long time, but it fully blossoms in this period. What happens in the early 50s when he goes back to Guinea, and what does that sort of become?
So one of the things that, you know, normally when people write about Cabral and people write about nationalism and people write about, you know, these big figures, you know, Che Guevara, even Nelson Mandela, and so on, you read these books, you know, and it's like, and what a lot of people do, and even, you know, Patrick Chabal has written a wonderful book on Cabral in the 80s and so on. They write about, these figures, childhood and so on. And they, you know, and they sort of come up with justifications, or they see a direct link between, you know, how these people grow up and what they end up doing later on. I think one of the things that I try to do with this book, you know, is to say that, like, the passage for Cabral from, you know, like a normal life to political activism is not straightforward. You know, I had a lot of doubts, and I really think that his career, his life, could have taken a different path, you know. But there are a number of events that take place and sort of push him into internationalism. You know, the first one was the nun of Sekou Touré. When De Gaulle travels to many places in Africa to promote the idea that of the union to be established between France and African colonies, right? And Sékou Touré says no, and so on. And so, you know, Guinea-Conakry becomes independent, and Guinea-Conakry starts to receive a lot of nationalists, right? A lot of people fighting for liberation of their countries, of, you know, people in Cameroon, Congo, and so on. So I think this is the first major element, you know. So because Guinea-Conakry was so close to Guinea-Bissau, so it was a base from which an anti-colonial war could start, you know, a place from which an anti-colonial war could start. And also, you know, the fact that when this generation, you know, people from students, mostly students, so young professionals from Angola, Mozambique, Cape Verde, Saint Tome, when they start to awaken to the situation of colonialism, and to sort of imagine, you know, what could happen to their countries, because they could see that a lot of African countries were becoming independent. Salazar was not interested in having a dialogue, you know, because we know that many places were, really few places in Africa became independent as the result of, you know, struggle of armed conflict. You know, a lot of places became independent because of agreements between, you know, the mother countries and the colonies, places like Ghana and so on. But by the, you know, late 50s, in the 60s, Cabral and everybody knew that Salazar would never negotiate independence, you know. Because of the fact I was saying before, he even denied that Portugal had colonies, you know. So if Portugal did not have colonies, how could Salazar start discussing or start, you know, how would Salazar start any kind of discussion with nationalists about independence, because Portugal was not a colonial power. And then, and a third aspect that I think that also is important is the fact that for people like Cabral for people like Agostinho Neto in Angola, was that now was the role that Soviet Union was playing in this situation, you know, because Soviet Union was really interested in supporting countries all over the world, particularly in Africa, to becoming independent, right? So there was in a certain way, there was this availability of, and also not only Soviet Union, you know, like the Eastern Bloc. So there was availability of resources to start an anti-colonial war to end Portuguese colonialism in Africa. So I really think that these are the factors that lead Cabral into the kind of nationalism that he embraced in the 50s.
And how does Cabral manage the PAIGC? How does it conduct this war against the Portuguese?
The war started around 63, 64, and actually, you know, the first clashes between Portuguese and African nationalists took place in Angola. And Cabral was, you know, was, I think that's the reason I call him reluctant. You know, he was a reluctant nationalist. He was a reluctant soldier. And I think he was pushed into the war because he didn't have any other resources. You know, it was not like in many places in Africa, in Ghana and so on, even in Guinea-Conakry, where you have some semblance of civil society. Right, you have groups that could protest against colonialism and so on, and put colonial powers, France and Portugal, in a situation that they had to negotiate. Right, in Guinea-Bissau, the first time that people went to the street to protest, and that was in Pidjegiti, the port of Pidjegiti. That was the case in Angola, you know, in the 60s. When a group of cotton pickers, peasants, protest against labor conditions and so on. So the Portuguese were not interested in negotiating. You know, they just bombed Baixa de Kisanji and they killed hundreds of people, perhaps thousands of people. You know, in Guinea-Bissau, with the port of Pidjegiti was the same. In Saint Tome, principle was the same. So Amílcar Cabral knew that the Portuguese would not negotiate. So he knew that he had to be prepared to start an armed struggle in order to liberate his country. So he created his bases. The first base was actually in Conakry, and then he started to move inside the country. One of the things that Cabral want to do, because we know what happened in Angola, you know, when the war started, was in the border, you know, from Congo, and soldiers actually came from Congo and entered into Angolan territories and killed white farmers, Portuguese farmers, and so on. But Cabral wanted to start the war inside the territory. So they attacked a Portuguese military base in Tite, and so that was when the war started. And for Cabral, you know, he had to think about, you know, what kind of war he would engage with, you know? And we know that we know from the literature, you know, particularly Mao, Mao Zedong, and what he has written about war as well. But he knows as well, because would be very hard for him to follow Mao's precepts, because one of the things that Mao writes and says about, you know, is that the nationalist or the insurgent group has to be, you know, inside the population, you know? And we know that, you know, the PAIGC had some limitations. Cabral himself was not a soldier. And he himself spent a great part of his time outside the Guinean territory, you know. So going into using like a sort of old Maoist technique to start a war in Guinea, I think would be a way to give too much power to the military. And he wants to avoid that, you know. And so Che Guevara was, you know, like a sort of provide some elements as well for how they organized PAIGC, you know, in the sense that they called it was un partido de quadros, a party of cadres, you know, of intellectuals, and trying to connect, right, the population, general population, you know, with a group of intellectuals that guide the war. I think, but you know, but there are a lot of problems that the guerrilla in Guinea-Bissau had to think about, you know, because one of the things that is important for anyone who starts a guerrilla is and Cabral has written about that, and he was aware of the geographical situation of Guinea. Guinea doesn't have like mountains like a Sierra Maestra in Cuba, or even in Cape Verde, you know, in certain places in Cape Verde, but they have good conditions, at least mountains that you can use to start a wall, so that to create these sort of sanctuaries that the Portuguese would not be able to take. So Guinea didn't have that, you know, didn't have mountains. So they really had to use the natural conditions of Guinea in order to fight the Portuguese, because they knew that the war would also be hard for the Portuguese, right? You know, Guinea is very humid, and Guinea has like all these conditions for malaria and so on. So it was actually a very hard place for the Portuguese to fight our war. But it was like, so what happened? And I think another aspect also to be considered, and I think this perhaps explains the fact that the war took so long, right, from 63 to 74, was the fact that Cabral didn't want to win independence through the war. You know, for him, the war was like more a means to get to force Portugal to negotiate. So the war was just, you know, a way to create the liberated zones, or to protect the liberated zones, so that some work, social work, could be done in terms of education, in terms of health, and so on. But he didn't want to push the Portuguese out of Guinea, because this would just make everything even worse. Because they would have to use more resources, they would have to use more soldiers, and then, you know, and they would have to, and they would have more problems, you know, because more people are engaged in war, the more people die, and so on. So for him, the war was just a way to force Portugal to negotiate, and I think this is what end up happening with the revolution in Portugal.
But it's a cruel irony, of course, that Cabral doesn't actually live to see that revolution. What leads to his death in 1973, and what effect does this have really on the future of Cape Verde and Guinea-Bissau?
I think I was saying, you know, there were a lot of issues that were cropping up, and then the party didn't have time to solve, because, you know, the leadership structure of the party was like, as I was explaining before, the soldiers were Guinean, so those who would fight and those who would die were from Guinea, right? And the leadership, the top, was formed by Cape Verdeans and Guineans as well. So this starts to bring a lot of resentment, you know, because Guineans were convinced, knew that they were actually the ones that were paying for the war. And then Cabral tried to expand the war into Guinea, so to have like a more balanced outcome, but it didn't work, because, you know, first of all, because Cape Verdeans were not interested in the war. Most Cape Verdeans were not even interested in independence and so on. So this started to create a lot of problems, you know, particularly after 68, when Spindler, who later on became president of Portugal after the Carnation Revolution in 74, when Spindler moved to Guinea as the commander of Portuguese troops and the governor, he realized that he could make some gains if he made this disentanglement between Portuguese and Guineans, right? So he started to promote, to push for, and to enforce actually Guinean identity, and particularly the resentment against Cape Verde, you know. And also the PAIGC didn't have, so what happened after 68 was a sort of corridor open between Bissau and Guinea-Conakry, or Conakry, right? Where you have a lot of people, deserters, people just coming back and forth, you know? And there was not like a lot of control about how to deal with, you know, with people who are coming with from Guinea and were interested in joining the forces of PAIGC in the countryside, or even in Conakry. So there are like a lot of, you know, people back, going back and forth and so on. So a lot of a lot of people criticizing Cabral openly and disagreeing with Cabral openly, you know. Particularly a lot of people thinking that perhaps Guineans should go for independence without the Cape Verdeans, you know. And I really think that was like the sort of environment that create the conditions for this group to emerge and to kill Cabral in 73. Because even, you know, if in the literature and a lot of people who I talk with told me is that, you know, the killing of Cabral was not like just a sort of assassination, right? Was really a coup d'etat. And it was not a coup d'etat against Cabral, right? It was a coup d'etat against Cape Verdeans within PAIGC, because they are a group of Guineans who would want to have a party, or who would at least want to negotiate independence with Portugal without the Cape Verdeans. So I think that was the situation that the party didn't not solve, or could not solve, or didn't know how to solve, that led to the death of Cabral.
Very good. Thank you so much for this talk. I'm just curious now. What are you working on next, or what are you thinking of working on next?
Well, I'm editing now a book that is coming out. I'm copy editing, actually. The book is coming out early next year through Duke University Press, and it's a totally different book. It also deals a lot with Portuguese colonialism, but it's about Luanda. So Luanda is the city I was born in Luanda, and I'm writing a book on Luanda, which is, you know, it's not part of my PhD dissertation. It's like two or one chapter of the dissertation, which I expanded into a book. And the book is called In the Skin of the City, Special Transformation in Luanda. And it's coming out next year through Duke University Press. So this is one project. But I'm really fascinated with the issue of war, insurgency, counterinsurgency, and so on. So my next project is about the war in Angola. You know, Angola had like one of the longest war in the world. So I'm now also start to do research, particularly around the invasion of South Africa, of Angola, in 70. 1975. So when the Portuguese were leaving Angola and South Africa invaded Angola militarily to prevent Angola from becoming independent. So I'm starting to work on this book on the Angolan Wars.
Fascinating. I'll look forward to reading it. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Ed. It has been a pleasure to talk to you.